This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. This week, we'll continue the series called A Summer Celebration of Women with a bit of a twist on this July 4th evening. I hope you all had a relaxing and enjoyable holiday. This week, where we celebrate America, we've been presenting two concerts given by the Philadelphia-based Dolce Suono Ensemble, led by their founder, artistic director, and flutist, Mimi Stillman. The concerts were given back in February and March and were called Rediscoveries, a Festival of American Chamber Music. The first broadcast was this past Tuesday. The second concert will be aired tomorrow at noon as part of our Celebrating Our Musical Community series. The featured composers on these concerts mainly wrote in the middle decades of the 20th century, but also on these programs were new works commissioned by Dolce Suono Ensemble. The composers were men and women, some well-known, some not so, but more to the point, nearly all of these established composers' chamber music works are rarely played in concert. This Tuesday broadcast presented works by Norman Delajoyo, Elliot Carter, William Schumann, Irving Fine, and Leonard Bernstein, but in keeping with the summer cadenza theme, also music by the late Catherine Hoover, and a work commissioned by the Dolce Suono Ensemble for their Mahler 100 Schoenberg 60 series back in 2011, commemorating the death anniversaries of those two great composers, a song cycle by Israeli-American composer Shulamit Ron. Of course, all these Dolce Suono Ensemble concerts we bring you shine a spotlight on what Mimi Stillman has created with this ensemble made up of these incredibly talented and distinguished musicians. Mimi's career, since being the youngest wind player ever accepted to the Curtis Institute and then further studies with the legendary Julius Baker, well, she has been called by the New York Times a consummate and charismatic performer. She has appeared as soloist with many major orchestras, chamber orchestras, and festivals across the U.S. and Europe. She teaches at Temple University and the Curtis Summerfest. She has also authored books on music and history. So this program is in anticipation of the broadcast at noon tomorrow of the second Rediscoveries of Festival of American Chamber Music, a concert which took place back in March, presented by Dolce Suono Ensemble. It featured a completely different lineup of composers from the concert we aired on Tuesday. Here, Dolce Suono Ensemble, with guest artists, performed music of George Rochberg, Richard Wernick, Walter Piston, Leon Kirshner, Ralph Shapey, George Pearl, and Louise Talma. But this concert was really a double bill with a panel discussion at intermission with American composer Richard Wernick, conductor and longtime artistic director of Orchestra 2001 James Freeman, with contributions from guest artist and past cadenza guest violinist Miranda Cookson, pianist Charles Abramovic, all introduced by Mimi. So here is that panel discussion as the core of tonight's program, as these artists discuss American chamber music. Before we go to the discussion, here's Mimi with her longtime music-making companion, pianist Charles Abramovic, who's also a permanent member of Dolce Suono Ensemble and professor of keyboard studies at Temple University, and New York Philharmonic cellist, and also member of Dolce Suono, Nathan Vickery, in the first movement, O'Keefe, inspired by Georgia O'Keefe, from American Canvas, from Pulitzer Prize and Grammy Award-winning and past cadenza guest American composer, Jennifer Higdon.
Thank you. Chamber music. It's really fun to play and talk, and we do a lot of both in general in our lives as musicians, but we don't always get to share the fascinating conversations that go into planning and preparing projects and programs with you, our dear audience members. So I first thought of this project idea with American Chamber Music of this kind of several generations 7 years ago. So it's been really fun studying music and reading about it and eventually making it happen with this phenomenal team of artists and also artistic advisors. So through some conversations with both Jim Freeman and Richard Warnick, learning about this and framing it, because once you delve into any rich area, it's actually hard to choose the program and actually feel like you've covered something in only two evenings or afternoons. That's why we're squeezing a little extra music in here today. But first, what we're going to do, I'm going to introduce some of our speakers. We're going to have time for your questions. We're happy to reflect on any other things that you've heard from what we played, things that you're going to hear, any questions at all. But let me first start by introducing to my right, Richard Wernick. Dick has become a dear friend. I'm so lucky. He is a very distinguished Pulitzer Prize-winning composer. He was artistic advisor on new music to the Philadelphia Orchestra and to Maestro Ricardo Muti, and he is professor emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania, so very important pedagogue as well. Also, another dear friend, and also very lucky, Jim Freeman, founding artistic director and conductor of Orchestra 2001, which he led through, I think, 27 years, is it? And numerous commissions of important new works and recordings, and just such a great oeuvre that was really launched by you in that capacity. And now, conductor and artistic director of Chamber Orchestra First Editions, and had the pleasure of playing with you many times as soloist and as a member. So we're thrilled to have you here as well. Also performing, so you'll get into that with everything. You've already kind of met the artists. So I'm going to first actually ask these gentlemen to maybe talk a little bit about rediscoveries or your personal connections with some of the composers, both from your studies and later in your career as performing composers.
Thank you, Mimi. It's very sobering to look back and realize that I, with the exception of Walter Piston, I knew all the composers on this program. I didn't know Louise Talma very well, I met her a couple of times, but all the others I had very close relationships with. I look back on this, I have to say parenthetically, it's very sobering to look at that list of composers and realize I'm the only one that's still living. And I don't know how much longer that's going to last. But what strikes me so strongly, given the what I consider the present state of our culture generally, is that not only are all these pieces very, very different, but they share one very important thing in common, and that is the attention to detail, the sense of musical thought, the seriousness of approach. There's nothing frivolous, there's nothing that wants to be immediately successful that you feel coming out of any of its music. Even the lighter side is music that's meant to make an impression, meant to be listened to and thought about after, and then heard again. So I think it's wonderful you put this together. You want to say something, Jim?
Sure. Why don't we go back and forth or something like that?
It's a great, it's a wonderful program, Mimi. And I also have a close relationship with all the pieces and all the composers, amazingly enough. And I even knew Walter Piston a little bit. I never took a course with him. I was too young at that time. But I do remember walking around Payne Hall in Harvard and seeing him walking around. And that was about it. But more than that, to start with Piston, when I was an undergraduate, I had a good friend who was a very good flute player, and his name was Neil Zaslaw. And Neil Zaslaw was, and I played a lot of recitals together around Boston, and of course we played the Piston. So that was like bringing back a warm, wonderful old friend. I know we didn't play it anywhere nearly as well as you guys did now, but we played it. But anyway, Neil Zaslaw, after we graduated, 2 or 3 years, put down the flute and became a musicologist and has become one of the really great Mozart scholars. His book on Mozart symphonies is a great masterpiece, I think. Amazing, amazing book. I do want to tell one more funny story about Piston, and I'll get it back to remember. My father was a bass player in the Boston Symphony and Boston Pops for many years. And when it came time with Fiedler to record another piece, that I'm sure you know very well, Mimi, The Incredible Flutist of Walter Piston, which is a wonderful piece, I think it's a terrific piece. And it came to the recording session of the piece, and there's a place after a sort of festive ballet that happens in the middle of the piece where at the end of a lot of crowd noise, there's a dog that's supposed to bark. And it's written into the percussion part. But it came to the recording session, and the principal percussion player in the Pops apparently said, bow wow, bow wow. and Peter said, no, that's not right. So at that point, everybody in the orchestra chimed in with their own barks. And there was a great chorus of woof, woof, and yip, yip. And finally, my father joined in, and I guess he said, roof, roof. And Peter said, that's it. That's it. So if you ever listen to that recording of the incredible flutist, it's my father barking. And the funny thing about it is that he came out after the recording session, and there was a note on the windshield of his car that said, Principal Dog, Boston
House. That is what is called oral tradition. Yeah.
That is fantastic. Actually, I'm going to ask you to go a little bit into neoclassicism in a moment, but first I just wanted to give a special welcome and invitation to Miranda Cookson, who is incredibly well-known, making huge contributions in our field on a lot of the composers you're hearing today, a whole album of Ralph Shapey, but 20th, 21st century music specialist, and I've just been so looking forward to making music with you for the first time through this project, and so I'd love to know a little bit about perhaps your reflections on Shapey, which you're going to be hearing soon, or anything you want to go with this whole rediscoveries idea.
Well, it's really a pleasure to be here, and as Mimi said, for us to work together for the first time. Yeah, and it's really a pleasure to be part of this program because it's an area of music that I've been very interested in for, I don't know, like the last dozen years or so. And when I was doing my graduate degrees in school, I got somehow very drawn into the whole area of American music and what does that mean to be a classical musician in this country, because it's so derived from Europe. So yes, I started exploring a number of composers' works, including some of those that we're hearing today. And one of them I really got into was Ralph Shapey, who's one of whose pieces I'm going to play today. Was a major figure, mostly in Chicago, though he was born here in Philadelphia. Yeah, was a very respected teacher, also conductor of the ensemble there. Really advocated for a lot of other composers' works, and he has a very distinctive style, let's say. I think you definitely hear a certain Schoenberg influence in some of these pieces because that was a major strain of his in those days, so you'll hear it coming up, particularly in the Kirchner and the Pearl pieces. Shapey was looking even further back to great composers like Beethoven and Bach and Haydn, and was very interested in very concrete ideas. And another thing to note, which maybe I didn't mention, is that he was also very influenced by abstract expressionist painters, in particular de Kooning and some others that he got to know in New York before he went to Chicago. And you can kind of see in his visualize with his music the idea of different shapes and the space around those. And so it's an interesting way of listening to his music. But yeah, Shapey's been one, and sort of all this context that I've played Pistons Concerto, and I've got some Roger Sessions, and Thomas Violin Sonata, which is wonderful, so it's great to tie all these pieces together.
One thing about Ralph was a very, very close and dear friend, and Ralph had a reputation as being a real tough guy. Ralph was one of the pussycats in the world. But one of my favorite Ralph stories is when I was chairman University of Pennsylvania, and I had a leave replacement. I think it was Rockford, George Rockford was going on leave, and I invited Ralph. And I got a call from the dean. And he said, You can't invite this man Shapey, he doesn't have a doctorate. I said, if you look at this record, not only doesn't he not have a doctorate, he doesn't have a master's degree. He also doesn't have a bachelor's degree. And the story is that he barely got a high school diploma because he beat up the principal. That's right.
I like how we're getting the behind-the-scenes stories on all these figures. This is great. Jim?
Just, I didn't know Ralph Shapey nearly as well as you did, Dave. But I did, when I was, during the many years I was teaching at Swarthmore College, I did have a run a class called Contemporary Composers, and in fact, you came to it one time, Dick, and you left a great mark on me at that class. You said some things that I remembered forever. I'll tell you about them. But Ralph also came at another time. And what I remember about Ralph then was, in the middle of the class, it was a very interesting class. It was a class in which the students listened to music by the composer all week long. And then the composer showed up, and they had a chance to quiz him about, or her, about the music that they heard. And Ralph was a good session with Ralph until the middle, when he suddenly said, "You know what the greatest piece ever written is?" And, you know, everybody stopped dead in their tracks. And he said, "Beethoven's Große Fugue." And one of the students stood up and said, "Yeah, that must be one of the greatest pieces, but there are many other..." "No, no, the greatest Große Fugue is the greatest piece ever written." And I think that was Ralph, wasn't it?
That was Ralph.
Yes.
Yeah. But no, Ralph had a great understanding of the roots of his roots. He always complained about those guys, maybe Beethoven and Mozart, right? Those guys. How did they figure out how to do that? He wanted to do the same thing. But once you got to know him, you got to know how his mind was working, and his music, as you'll hear, is totally different. This is not a scintilla of Beethoven or Mozart or Haydn. But what made Beethoven and Mozart and Haydn possible made Shakey possible. And that's evident, really is.
Well, actually, while we were talking about some of a Boston connection through Harvard and Walter Piston, the Piston Sonata that we played is actually the earliest piece on this whole project, written in 1930. And Charlie and I performed it a lot in recital and in our discussions, because Charlie, you were instrumental in programming this project and introducing me to, for example, the Leon Kirshner piano trio that you're going to play soon. But Piston is really central, one of the central figures in this idea of the composers like Roger Sessions, born in the 1890s, who were important both for their music but also for their teaching and writing. So Piston taught composers as far-ranging as Leonard Bernstein, Elliot Carter, Leroy Anderson at Harvard, and many, many more, including some of the other composers, if you've been with us throughout the season, you've been hearing, such as Irving Fine and Arthur Berger. So we wanted to be sure to ask you, Dick, a little bit, and Jim, any personal experiences, because I know you studied very closely any of these composers, including Harold Shapiro as well, very well at Brandeis. So we would love to hear about that a little bit. And Charlie and I also plan to ask you specifically, because you're going to hear some Candide, about American Musical Theater Studies at Brandeis as well. Charlie, did you want to add to that question? Yeah, take it away. Thanks.
Well, what you're talking about is neoclassicism. Stravinsky was a very smart guy. And there were two things that happened after the First World War, which are very important to understand. Number one, I think Stravinsky, and I get this from Harold Shapiro, from Irving Fine, from Aaron Copland, who knew Stravinsky very, very well. I did not know Stravinsky. But the take was that after those three big ballets culminating in the Rite of Spring, and then you had a war, and the economy in Europe was wiped out. And so what did you do with music? And there was a significant change at that point that manifested itself for probably the first time, at least one, in which the idea was to not only reduce the size of the ensembles to something that would be reasonable and be performed and be economical, but to looking back that kind of almost economic gesture was also reflected in the kind of musical sense that the classical period was so rich. And then after Mozart, early Beethoven, you start to get into romantic music, you get to Schumann, you get to Schubert, you get to Brahms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there was a lot of stuff left in the whole neoclassical ethic that could be applied to new music. And Stravinsky latched onto that and started a movement of looking back and writing music that was not just in one key, but in
two keys or three keys simultaneously, using the principles of Western tonality, which is one of the great cultural and intellectual constructs of the world and world history, and to not discard that, but to transform it into something that could support 20th century musical ideas. And that was picked up in many ways by the Boston School. I mean, Piston was certainly part of that. Randall Thompson was part of that. The Harvard, you know, composers. Copland was part of it, although he was not centrally in Boston, but you had Irving Fine, Arthur Berger, Lenny Bernstein, Harold Shapiro. You had a whole group of people that just glommed onto that whole notion and produced a corpus of work that had influence outside of neoclassical music. When you get involved with composers like Peter Menin and William Schumann, you're still dealing with a kind of neoclassicism, not the forms, but the structures and the way the music worked. So one of the things I always try to teach my students is that there is no such thing as atonal music, unless you make noise. And even there, a good percussion piece has elements of tonality. And for me, that is so important to be focused back on that period right after World War I. Do you have any comments on that? I agree. I'd like to, if I can, just a story which relates several composers on your program together in a way, and me. Dorothy and I came to Philadelphia in 1966. Almost the first thing that happened, we were invited to play as members of the Penn Contemporary Players. And it was conducted by a man named Mel Strauss, who was the only left-handed conductor I've ever played for, but he was a good guy. One of the first pieces on the program that we played was George Rockberg's Music for Magic Theater, which is one of the pieces that has always struck me as being incredibly personal for him, but also incredibly weird. The outer three movements, the outer two movements are like what you heard with the Contramortem et Tempus, very modern, very full of angst, but it has quotations, rather clear quotations, from Beethoven and Mahler. Now, the middle movement is a complete reversal of a Mozart serenade movement. 15 minutes of a Mozart serenade movement, which Rockberg reconstructed and added winds and a piano part, but it's all Mozart. And I remember thinking, this is the weirdest thing I've ever heard. It offended a lot of people. I remember my colleague at Swarthmore College was then Claudio Spies. I don't know if you knew him. But Claudio came out of that concert saying, this is the most ridiculous and horrible thing I've ever heard of. But it was George Rockberg, and it fascinated me. I didn't like the piece, I can confess, but it was fascinating. But anyway, to continue the story, the next year, George Rockberg was the chairman of the music department. Mel Strauss had left, and he brought in the New York Players. Gil Kalish, my friend, your friend, Jan, Ronnie Roseman, people like that, the great New York freelance players to play the contemporary players. And I wrote to George Rockberg. I was 25 and nobody instructor at Swarthmore College. And I wrote to George with great trepidation and said, Mr. Rockberg, I think you're doing the wrong thing. I think if you want new music to flourish in Philadelphia, it's got to be with Philadelphians. And he wrote back a very nice letter. Said, yeah, I understand your point, but I do disagree. Well, the next year, Richard Morgan was appointed and became the director of the Penn Contemporary Players. And he immediately went back to the Philadelphia Freelance Players. And we were all so pleased and so delighted. And the Penn Contemporary Players then became a focus for new music in Philadelphia in a way that was just extraordinary. So I want to congratulate you on that. Thank you. There was one exception. There was one. I told George, this is what I'm doing. We're going to do it with local talent. There's a lot of people around, but I am not giving up Chandler Guy time.
That's great. Wow, this is a fascinating anecdote. Yes. Actually, while we're talking about George Rothberg, and before some of the artists will have to go re-warm up for the next half, there's some musical borrowings in the Rothberg piece that you heard us play, Contra Mortem et Tempus, from Weber and from Varese and some other composers. I think they're buried in there, and it would be hard to say, oh, that's Weber and Berg, that kind of thing. But the piece unfolds in a little bit different way from other music, because sometimes we're waiting for each other or waiting for something to happen before we do our next thing. And I thought, since we have the benefit of, yeah, I know you don't know, I'm going to ask you about this, but would you explain a little bit about the piece that you're served by Rothberg, how the score is laid out, and how we sometimes do the timings of our entrances and when we like start and stop?
So the score is the first line is flute and clarinet, violin, and then piano. So it's not a traditional way of reading a score. So it's actually, I was in the first week, so I was having a little bit hard time to make the cues. Where, you know, if I have an entrance with a piano, or the flute, or the violin. But so I sort of make a little bit mark by, you know, like a little bit line, you know, where's the cues.
Exactly, that's really interesting. So just that's what we were looking at, just a different way in music of expressing time. And while we're on the concept of time, it'll be expressed very differently in the Kirshner you're going to hear and the George Burrell. And I thought if anyone in the piano trio wants to say something about that piece, what we can listen for, or even, I would love for us to preview a little bit how the rhythms are worked out in Pearl. So very much not up to chance in the same way Rothberg has it laid out, where we sometimes wait for each other or wait for a few seconds that he denotes before doing something. So I don't know, Gabe, anything or random, Charlie?
You won't notice.
I don't think you'll notice a difference. So that to me is interesting. Like, there are always different ways that composers choose to express their language, but ultimately they're expressing something that is not very strict in that way. So if we have bars with time signatures that you won't be able to pick out, or metric modulations, like part of that is we have to create the music out of it that we think that the composer intended. I think that would be clear in any of the pieces on this program, no matter how the scores are laid out.
Just 30 seconds of history more, if I can. I first heard Contra Mortem et Tempus at Swarthmore College in about 1966 or 67, as played by Gil Kalish and Paul Joukowsky, and two players from New York. I don't remember who they were, but they had been appointed to Swarthmore, to teach at Swarthmore College the same year I had, and that piece has always brought back fond memories too.
Actually, when I was a Curtis student, some friends and I, such as composer David Ludwig and Daniel Kellogg, and our faculty advisor was Jennifer Higdon, formed an ensemble to play music by Curtis composers, and Rothberg actually attended at the time our performance. So yeah, it's great to revisit this important work. We did definitely want to, because we're going to be playing Charlie's wonderful arrangement of the Overture to Candide. Tell us a little bit about Bernstein and the festivals at Brandeis, if you would, Dick, that you helped organize, I think, with Mrs. Wernick as well, and some of the figures that came through while Bernstein was writing both West Side Story and Candide.
You have a little bit of a mistake in the program. Lenny Bernstein and I, he and I didn't organize festivals. I worked on two festivals with him when I was a student. I got to know him, you know, very well when I was a student at Brandeis. It was later that B and I were invited to come back and do the last of the Brandeis Creative Arts Festivals. I don't know whether that's cause and effect or what, but those are wonderful memories. The first concert that we worked on together, you won't believe this, you think this is a long concert. The concert started with the premiere performance of Trouble in Tahiti, the opera, staged in the big Allman Amphitheater that I don't think exists at Brandeis anymore. That was followed by two performances of Les Noces of Stravinsky, then choreographed by Merce Cunningham. One was a solo by Merce Cunningham, and the other was an ensemble ballet. That's not a short piece. And then after intermission was the first American performance of the Blitzstein translation of Three Penny Opera. And aside from working with Bernstein and Harold Shapiro and Irving Fine, who was the choral director and all those wonderful things, One of my most vivid memories is that I did get to work a little bit with Lottie Lenno, who's about this big, and had a personality that could absolutely blow everything away. That was an incredible, incredible experience. Those festivals, you know, went on. I don't know why they stopped. They did the Le Marmel de Tiresias and Darius Milhaud. They did the concert performance of Tender Land and of Aaron Copland. Morton Gould had written a tap dance concerto. Do you know about that?
With a cadenza, right.
And I forget who it was it there? There was a Larry Adler and another dancer. Those were heady days. And I look back on that. That was the best part of my musical education. It was not the courses, the tour, all that stuff, the real world.
I'm going to ask a big question, and then I'm going to invite all of you to ask your questions and chat with us. But the question is really kind of at the core of this project, which is we're playing a lot of chamber music by important, distinguished composers who are really well-known outside of music as public figures as well throughout this project. So why? Why is this music not getting performed? I'll say it enough today.
It's a tough field. To have a piece in the standard repertoire is tough. Mm-hmm. And it's tough for the old guys too. How many piano sonatas of Beethoven would be considered standard repertoire that you hear all the time in concerts? Not that many. Yeah. Not that many. How many symphonies of Mozart are in standard repertoire? How many symphonies of Haydn are in the standard repertoire? Yep, very few. The composer who has the largest percentage, largest proportion of his music in his standard repertoire is Brahms. And that's because when he was young, he threw all his music away, and none of the stuff that might be secondary repertoire is even extant. So there's nothing to worry about.
And he only wrote four symphonies.
He only wrote four symphonies, and he was a very smart boy.
There's something unique about this period of American composers because I think they weren't concentrating on smaller groups and ensembles. So many were writing symphonies, and you see this drone Schumann, these amazing symphonies. You hear these things are staggering. And the Piston Symphonies, I think he wrote six or seven of these, and Roy Harris. So there isn't a lot, actually. It's a little difficult with maybe to put this program together. That's why we have some solo pieces and we have some interesting ensemble works. I think from my, I hate to say this in front of experts, but it seems like the idea of more chamber-oriented pieces happened actually later with contemporary composers. So from a very practical point of view, most people, how many symphonic works of George Crumb, for example, do we have? I know George Rockberg wrote some symphonic works, but those are really tough to get performed. There's no one like Koussevitzky around to do it.
I'm glad you mentioned just the name Koussevitzky because he was really an important part of this whole era.
Dick, you probably would add to that.
Koussevitzky, well, I grew up in Boston. And if you go into the archives, into a library, go into the Fleischer collection, just get the programs during the Koussevitzky period, almost every week there was a new piece. That was the way things were done.
Many by Americans.
First orchestral piece of Aaron Copland was done by Koussevitzky and the Boston Symphony Orchestra. I had the great privilege of hearing the world premiere of the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra. I was 11 years old, and I remember it as if it happened yesterday. But there was a sense of that's what music was. And it reflects a 19th century view of music also, that audiences in the middle of the 19th century, they didn't want to hear Mozart and Beethoven. That was old music. They were not interested in that. They wanted to know what Brahms was doing. What is that fourth symphony going to sound like? That was important to them, to know what the new music of the time was going to be like. And now it's completely changed. Part of it is the culture, it's the marketing, it's the position of major institutions vis-a-vis the public. We can go on all afternoon about this. But in response to what you raised, Mimi, about this repertoire, there's a lot of music out there, tons and tons and tons of wonderful music, and there simply are not the opportunities. And people do tend to play things that are familiar so that the audience can hear things that are familiar. And it's not just a problem of our time. The one piece in Pieces of Eight, the little Diabelli piece, when I wrote that, I took out the Diabelli variations, which I can't begin to play. But I read Hans von Bülow's introduction to that. And he raised the question, he said, why was it that one of the monumental masterpieces of all Western music sat on shelves gathering dust for years, for decades? And he said, I can answer my own question. It was the laziness of the musicians in regard to this kind of music, and also the debased musical culture of our time. Now, this is Hans von Bülow talking about Germany in 1870, the debased musical culture of our time. Nothing strange.
Well, yeah, great. Thank you so much. This has been unbelievably enriching and fascinating from our speakers. Do you have any questions? Yes. This is great. Thank you so much. Here, we can use the mic for that.
I'm not a fan of modern music or music from the 1950s. For me, it is an education to come and hear you play, and I appreciate that. I'm wondering if we do not use wrong terminology when we're talking about music. It seems to me that if we were to talk about music, that makes us wish to laugh, or to sing, or to dance, or to pray, or to scream, rather than whether it's classical or neoclassical or modern, we might get farther along in communicating with one another about things. I ended up in tears right at the end of several of the pieces you played earlier. I don't know them, I haven't heard them before. I can't whistle the tunes from them, and that's pretty important in our household, that I can either sing it or whistle it when I walk away. But I think that we do ourselves a disservice by being controlled by the academic descriptions of the musical era.
Thank you. That's so meaningful to hear. For me, would you like to respond to your comment?
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, to take any of the pieces, there were places in them where there was anger, where there's playfulness, where there's joy, where there was sorrow, there was grief. All of those things, I think, in every piece, in a different way. I think in response to your question, it's not a question of music being academic or not, or being described academically or not, but I do think that it is a difference of language. If you try and have a telephone call, if you're in a foreign country and you have a telephone call where you're speaking to somebody in a language that you're not really familiar with, you can't see the other person's body language. You can't see the face. You can't see expression. So you're relying simply on language. And what happens? I'm describing something scientific, which is very, very unscientific, is this is a kind of an oral feedback. Information comes into the ear, and it's processed in the brain. But the brain can't process it fast enough, so more stuff is coming into the ear, and you end up with a jumble that you don't, quote, understand. And the only solution is just to listen to it, become familiar with the language, just like learning French.
Well, I would just add to that I feel as someone from a younger generation than these gentlemen, but who's gotten very interested in this music, that I feel like a lot of this music has been rather unfairly just tagged with that academic label. And I mean, the fact is, the conservatories and the universities are places which provide livelihoods for a lot of artists and continue to. So even much younger now, composers and musicians have the same sorts of positions. But I think in that era, there was just a kind of image that set in and all the terminology along with it. But this is music that comes from all these universities and these intellectual sources and got kind of pigeonholed in that way. Obviously, this music is being created by people who are putting their hearts into it. If you just listen to it that way, that's what it is. But it's because of that, yeah, way of seeing who these people are.
Just a question.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Just a question for Dick. Do you think we're still caught in the sort of trap of Harvard versus Princeton, as it was in the 60s and 70s, when Harvard was the bed of neoclassicism and Princeton was the bed of Tofton, of Schoenberg? And they were fighting for years about that, and they each had their adherents and disciples. And in a way, I feel we've never really recovered from that fight.
Now, this I could be here for a No, I don't think that exists anymore. I think what exists now is something much worse, quite frankly. And I think that it's not just music. I think it's a reflection of the whole culture. We are going through a very difficult time, and one can analyze, is it a consequence of social media? Is it a consequence of the fact that the attention span has been reduced to 15 seconds? Is it a consequence of the fact that we become so visually demanding in such a way that you can't listen to anything abstract? You have to have some visual thing to look at. I think that the cultural situation today is weaker than that battle that took place in, as you say, between neoclassicism and so-called modernism, serialism, however you want to describe it. It was inevitable that whole thing was going to collapse into something. Now, I'm not suggesting that there are not a lot of people out there doing very, very serious work, but the major institutions in this country are not being helpful in this regard. I'm sorry, the programming of the Philadelphia Orchestra is lousy, period. And it's the same thing in New York, and the same thing in Boston, the same thing in Chicago, and the same thing in Cleveland, that there are no opportunities now for serious, really serious composers, as you say, people who wrote big symphonies like Bill Schumann. Those people don't exist because they don't have the opportunities.
Another question from the audience. Yes.
I just would like to say that the level of playing today is extraordinary, but also that the music is very difficult, and I think that one has to account for that. I mean, I think, for instance, orchestras have difficulty programming, even something like the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra, because it takes longer to put that together than a Beethoven symphony. And so that's part of the problem we're having right now. And I play in a contemporary music ensemble, and I know that putting pieces together like this takes hours and hours and hours. I hope you all appreciate that. And
thank you.
I often wonder if composers wouldn't serve themselves better if they wrote slightly easier, less complicated music. You can answer that too, my dear friend.
Beethoven was criticized at some point, I forget the exact circumstance, over one of his string quartets, whether it was the performers who were having trouble or whatever, and what Beethoven said was, this music isn't for now, it's for later.
Yeah.
Now, that was not a flip remark, but, Carol is my very, very dear friend, and so I can talk to you. Right?
We can discuss this later.
And, It's the old story, my dear. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice. Music is hard. It's not hard because it's harder to play. It's hard because it involves different kinds of techniques up to a point. It involves different kinds of gestures, different kinds of rhythms, different kinds of ensemble, different kinds of things. And that's where I see the problem, is a resistance to move forward, and it's reflected very much in our culture now by a kind of a simple-minded solution on the part of composers who do write pieces that are easy, that can be done by most orchestras on one rehearsal, and they don't need any study or depth, and they sound very nice and very coloristic, and you never want to hear them. And that's, for me, that's not what music is. music, aside from having a deep, very deep musical sense, also has a very deep intellectual sense.
It's not a new phenomenon. You know, at the premiere of Mozart's Entführung, the opera, the emperor famously said to Mozart after the performance, "Very nice, Wolfgang, but way too many notes." And that's what we're talking about.
I just wanted to thank you so much, Jim and Dick, Charlie, for joining us.
You've been listening to a panel discussion about American chamber music that was presented between two halves of a concert titled Rediscoveries, a festival of American chamber music presented by the Philadelphia-based Dolce Suono Ensemble last March. The panel was moderated by the founder, artistic director, and flutist in Dolce Suono, Mimi Stillman, and you heard the voices of composer Richard Wernick, conductor and longtime artistic director of Orchestra 2001, James Freeman, violinist Miranda Cookson, and pianist Charles Abramovic. The music concert that surrounded this panel discussion will air tomorrow at noon. We broadcast the first of these Festival of American Chamber Music concerts on Tuesday. You'll be able to listen to this special 4th of July cadenza and both Dolce Suono Rediscoveries, a Festival of American Chamber Music concerts, on our website as webcasts attached to this cadenza. And we hope you tune in tomorrow for that concert broadcast. Again, it'll feature music of Louise Talma, George Rochberg, Richard Wernick, Walter Piston, Leon Kirshner, Ralph Shapey, George Pearl, with some Bernstein thrown in as a fun encore, all performed by the Dolce Suono Trio of Mimi Stillman, Charles Abramovic, and Gabriel Cabezas on cello, with special guest artists Miranda Cookson on violin and viola, and Yao Guangjai on clarinet. Continuing my series, A Summer Celebration of Women, next week's program, we'll chat with the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for music back in 1983, Ellen Taef Zwillich. Following her will be a cadenza program with the 2019 Pulitzer Prize winner, composer Ellen Reed. I'll leave you with Mimi Stillman, along with pianist Charles Abramovic, performing music by an American composer who wrote a lot of music for flute, and Mimi premiered many of her works. Sadly, she passed away last year, Catherine Hoover. From her Mountain and Mesa for flute and piano, here are the second and third movements of this three-movement work, titled On the Mesa and Dizzy, D-I-Z-I, Dizzy Dance. Again, join us tomorrow at noon for the Dolce Suono Ensemble program recorded live in concert. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. You can catch any recent past cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and wwfm.org. Thank you.
Thank you.